Pictures of You, a workshop with Cara Walker and Rebecca Walker, curated by Luca Morena. Questions and answers.
My name is Filippo, and the group is Consequences. And the question is, for Cara, how and to what extent do you think the passage of time affects the contents of your work?
Well,
I guess there's two thoughts I had there. One was about, like, sort of physical effects on my work, and then there's this sort of external, emotional, political affect. Most of the work that I do kind of deals anachronistically with time. You know, I'm situated here now, but sort of reflecting on different periods of time or different sorts of representation of, say, racialized life in America, mostly, say, in the 19th century and early 20th century, and sort of I pop around different types of representations. But the effect of time on my physical work, like the cutouts, is kind of an interesting problem for me, because when I started making these cutout installations, I actually imagined that they would be temporary, that they would just exist for a short time as a flash, because I wanted the work to have this kind of physical impact where, you know, it wasn't just like something that existed forever as a part of the canon of art history, but it was something that was almost flash in the pan, like the unexpected sort of cry of an invisible artist. And so what's happened is the opposite. I wound up making work that's kind of got a life beyond my own, potentially. I don't know exactly how I feel about that. I mean, with some of the drawings and the framed works, I mean, that's maybe anticipated that it could live on without me. But the large installation works, like, they're as much a part of their own making, the time that they were made and the time that they exist in the world, I guess, I still imagine should be shorter than it is.
I'm Ruth Kerr, and the group is Extraneous Bodies. And this is the first question for Cara is more like a collection of questions. What can stereotypes tell us about humanity? Will stereotypes always exist in the collective human consciousness, or will we get rid of them eventually?
It's funny in a way, because the question, it's a bigger question than, you know, I feel capable of answering somehow, but I think my experience early on in trying to understand how stereotypes / archetypes kind of happen and operate in how we understand ourselves and in the stories that we tell about each other. Well, I just became aware, say, in my early 20s, that there's something really sort of base and human about stereotyping. It's very common, and it's a way of solidifying one's own sort of identity, right? By, you know, solidifying or imposing or projecting an identity onto another. And it's a way of sort of forcing some kind of stability in a situation, which I think life is much more kind of fluid and maybe even frightening and, you know, difficult to sort of, you know, ascertain moment to moment where one is. So, I mean, will stereotyping always kind of exist in some form? Probably. But, you know, there's also this kind of, I mentioned stereotype and archetype, and there's this kind of notion that, you know, in our collective, I mean, we have, you know, shared common experiences, you know, of being born and dying and, you know, moving through life in different stages. And so, yeah, I think the archetype lives hand in hand with the stereotype. It's this kind of need, wish, desire to, you know, identify that other that is outside ourselves, maybe greater than ourselves, and again, keeps identity somewhat stable, you know, keeps identity from dissolving altogether.
Are there any positive stereotypes that might spread and reinforce tolerance and acceptance? Does intention matter in applying a stereotype?
Tolerance and stuff. So I think that kind of comes back to this archetype idea to some extent. And you know, by archetype, you know, sort of talking about like a mother archetype, or you know, sort of archetypes of innocence or even evil. Tolerance and acceptance. I think that's why I started to look to you, Rebecca.
Okay. What initially came to mind is this. This one of the things that. Since I am a Buddhist, that His Holiness the Dalai Lama always says, and which is a key tenet of Buddhism, which is that we are all the same in that we all want to be happy. And that as a stereotype of sorts, you know, to look at every human being and stereotype them as someone who wants to be happy, we could see that as a stereotype. But that's actually one that could have a positive benefit, right? Because instead of otherizing, it harmonizes. And so that would be a stereotype that I wouldn't mind propagating, though I would probably recast it as an archetypal truth. But yes, I do see that there could be a positive benefit to stereotyping if we could.
I can get past my own limitations.
Jose, our group is Extraordinary Families. What kind of fight should women carry on in art? Do you believe art can still be a form of social struggle?
Well, you know, the struggle for quite a long time has been to make work as a woman artist or a woman artist of color without necessarily having to explain what being a woman artist or a woman of color actually is all the time, and without assuming that the audience viewing the work or listening or reading is something other than you. A lot of the fight that was happening in the 60s, 70s among women gaining some kind of entry into the canon has informed me and informed a lot of other women artists to the point that we can understand whether or not we want to be a part of the canon or if we want, you know, something else more representative of, like, a fluid interaction of ideas rather than, you know, becoming institutionalized in museums and galleries and things that have already kind of existed to serve maybe one idea of art making or... the second question...
Do you believe art can still be a form of social struggle?
Definitely. I do encounter a lot of students who feel very jaded about art as a force for social change, but I can't think of a better way, in a way, to sort of talk about a range of possibilities and ideas, especially if you're talking about politics or any kind of social situation in the world, really, because with art or the arts, a certain amount of empathy is required. I mean, any artist who is trying to kind of understand has already kind of metabolized empathy, you know, sort of openness to, like, whatever is, you know, whatever is in front of you at the moment. And I think when you're making art, there's a kind of a moment-to-moment awakening that then becomes material over, you know, a surface or, you know, throughout the pages of a book. And to create a situation where there's an audience, a viewer who, you know, responds in kind, I mean, that's the most amazing kind of openness. And within that, you know, there's trust. And understanding awakens from trust. And so if you can create a situation, and, you know, creating a situation is not so easy. You know, if you're a politician, you create a situation, it might become a war, or it might become, you know, a debate that goes on endlessly because people are trying to attain or maintain power. But with, art or things that cannot necessarily be named as politics or political action or even activism sometimes. Activism and art do actually go hand in hand because you're creating a situation where bodies and ideas and minds are coming together. So yes, I mean, my answer is emphatically yes.
And the name of the group is Diversity and Identity in the City. How is the artist, you artist, by means of experience, power and imagination, able to shake our habits and make us free from everyday limiting reactions?
It's a very big question. and I think it's a tall order in a way for the artist, but I my instinctive reaction was actually, well, I don't. You know, it's actually sort of do the opposite. I mean, what I think maybe what I aim for, what I kind of strive for, is to sort of put all of those first instinctive thoughts, those sort of glaring mistakes and misunderstandings, those misrepresentations that I also possess, and I just sort of put them there first. It's almost like those first ugly moments, those first ugly sort of thoughts and words are kind of instructive. I think what I hope, or what my aim is that by sort of seeing those initial responses, something else will start to sort of materialize internally, like a kind of shame, fear, anxiety about one's own sort of position relative to, you know, these thoughts, words, actions that are, you know, that one's confronted with, you know, visually. But the problem or the conundrum most of the time for me with making art or visual art is that it doesn't solve the problem. And it might be too much of a tall order to say that the art will solve the problem. The art will simply sort of maybe present the problem or present a situation where this activity can happen, where this kind of like interior recognition, shame, fear, titillation, joy, all that can start to happen. But what, you know, one does with that afterwards is kind of up to, you know, it's up to the individual. You know, the art sort of, in a way, gets away with being kind of a mute, you know, entity.
That's a great answer. Great answer. I think, like Kara, I would say, for me as an artist, I'm also trying to cut to such a searing, potentially controversial, stripped place through the writing, kind of honesty that is so shocking to people that they have to kind of be jolted out of their normal thinking. And also to try to do this kind of radical openness that will model the same for others. So whether I'm saying, you know, I had an abortion when I was 13, or I'm saying I was going to marry a devout Muslim man and wear a veil, you know, I'm trying to push my reader to imagine a different entire worldview and life lived in a way that is different from what they expect and thus, like, blows their mind in a kind of way.
You know, I think that a lot of the work that I start, well, the work that I do has this kind of, like, placid thing about it because I so resented artwork that was so, like, you know, it was politically driven and it was angry and it looked angry,
right?
Because it automatically shuts down the conversation. So, you know, for me, this idea of, you know, talking about empathy and politics and social change, it's also about sort of respecting the sort of readability, legibility, you know, conversationality of this interaction. The interaction, you know, even the mediated interaction of having an artwork or some kind of screen, you know, through which, you know, we're trying to communicate.
Yeah, that's deep. Be interesting to hear a lot of different artists respond to that question. Mm-hmm. It made me think of the Obama posters and what he was thinking about. Anyway.
My name is Victoria. I represent the group Whose Shadows, and I have two questions for Kara. Regarding the representation of social injustice that is essential to your work, do you succeed in putting some distance between you, your background, and your artworks? Or are you inevitably and always part of your works, not only as an author, but somehow also as a hidden subject?
I'm the hero, subject, author, and audience for all the work, and I'm very interested in that relationship. Initially, when I started doing the work with talking about race and stereotypes, I was really sort of thinking about literature and cheap literature at that. So, sort of romantic, pornographic, like books that really sort of make a sort of physical connection between the author, the character in the novel, and the reader. And I really kind of like that sort of triangulation, especially as, with romance novels, like the objective is to make the reader really feel something, like immediately or deeply. And in my work, I think I'm also, pretty engaged in a process of sort of, maybe not abstracting, but there's like my lived experience, a kind of a shaky line drawn between myself and myself as a third person character in my own narrative. And then this kind of like mediated sort of situation of sort of like either writing or drawing or doing some kind of an artwork that makes a connection between this like self and idealized self. So yeah, I play all those roles. And especially with the shadow puppet films, it's much more sort of obvious there because I'm, literally behind the screen making the narrative happen.
Do you see yourself not only as a visual artist, but also as a kind of visual narrator? Is there a line in continuity between your style of visual narration and the styles that have been used by the masters of the past? Why do you use shadows, silhouettes instead of the images?
I do many things, not just with shadows and silhouettes, but I always think of myself as a visual artist because it's a catch-all for the thing that I do. But I have a kind of a range of things that I do before I get to the drawings and the cutouts. There's a kind of a writing practice that I have. It's not writing, but I do type and I kind of try to put together stories. I think I'm an unreliable narrator, if you want to think of narration. I'm not telling a straight story and there's oftentimes not that much truth to it, or sometimes there's a grain of truth that starts here and it wanders off down a path that looks, peculiarly like my own made-up stuff or like parts of my own life that have been attached haphazardly to a standard narrative. I'm interested in narrative, let's say, and it's always this kind of touchy bugaboo area for contemporary art because it's sort of, sort of frowned upon in some ways, the way drawing used to be frowned upon in the 80s. I'm very interested in the way that, we try to tell stories, the way we succeed in telling stories, and the way we fail in telling stories. And I really kind of like this, those funny places where the lie kind of enters into, the fiction becomes a part of the telling of a factual story. Even as you begin to tell the story, it already starts to take the shape of not what it was. You can never sort of represent the lived event adequately the minute you start narrating it. So that's the kind of thing that's inspiring to me. I said earlier, sort of there's an anachronistic kind of act that's going on in my work. I started out making paintings, oil paintings, and, figurative mostly, but thinking sort of abstractly and metaphorically about, different things. And I began almost as a joke to first explore early American art, and I was thinking about identity formation and looking at different moments in American history and in African American history of, trying to, visual representations of identity formation is what I was interested in, and partly for my own sort of, awakening as a young woman. So my work sort of harkens back to, to find a kind of a look of emergence, of sort of just beginning. And for me, the sort of emergent African-American woman identity that I felt like a close affinity to was like a sort of mid-19th century kind of attitude. But it's completely malleable. You know, I'm not studying costumes necessarily, but I am sort of looking at, you know, American art in particular and some European art from about 1776, let's say, and the sort of emergence of a new idea of, you know, selfhood and independence. As, you know, this is sort of what I touch on. And then for specific, you know, artists that I, you know, draw on, it's less the, there's some masters, some sort of great, you know, Goya, but a lot of the work that I tend to respond to were sort of illustrators and cartoonists of their time. They were sort of like outside of the main canon of fine art, like Hogarth or Daumier, skirted the line between both high and low. Well, I do a lot of drawings, actually, and I do the cutouts and silhouettes. It's a long answer. that's connected to many things, but part of it was a rejection of painting and a rejection of my own sort of reliance on a certain kind of oil painting, because I felt that it was not an art form that actually had my best interests in mind as an African-American woman, like politically. And I found that the doing the cutouts was both structurally, physically, a kind of a violent act of removal, of sort of like claiming a shape from another space. And also there's a history to it, but it's like an underground history that doesn't necessarily link up with high art, fine art. It's like a second class citizen of art making. And so the two forms that I felt closest to when I started working this way was the silhouette, these sort of small, sort of feminine art forms, and then cyclorama, which was like, you know, sort of 19th century entertainment. This was pre-cinematic painting. That's painting that's gone so overboard and so inflated with its own sort of importance that it also went over the line and was no longer fine art either. So I kind of like this sort of low art and this, like, you know, hubris-filled high art that, you know, topples it over, you know, under its own weight.
This production was made possible thanks to Fondazione Merz, Torino, fondazionemerz.org. Radio Papesse è un progetto a cura di Carola Haupt e Ilaria Gadens. Radiopapesse.org